Mr. Astor determined to begin his enterprise with two expeditions, one by sea, the other by land. The former was to carry out everything necessary for the establishment of a fortified post at the mouth of the Columbia. The latter, under the conduct of Mr. Hunt, was to proceed up the Missouri and across the Rocky Mountains to the same point. In the course of this overland journey, the most practicable line of communication would be explored, and the best situations noted for the location of trading rendezvous. Following Mr. Irving in our brief summary of his narrative, we will now give some account of the first of these expeditions. A ship was provided called the Tonquin, of 290 tons, with 10 guns and 20 men. Lieutenant Jonathan Thorne of the United States Navy, being on leave of absence, received the command. He was a man of courage and had distinguished himself in the Tripolitan War. Four of the partners went in the ship, Mackay and McDougall, of whom we have already spoken, and Messrs. David and Robert Stewart, new associates in the firm. McDougall was empowered to act as the proxy of Mr. Astor in the absence of Mr. Hunt. 12 clerks were also of the party. These were bound to the service of the company for 5 years and were to receive $100 a year, payable at the expiration of the term, with an annual equipment of clothing to the amount of $40. By promises of future promotion, their interests were identified with those of Mr. Astor. 13 Canadian voyageurs and several artisans completed the ship's company. On the 8th of September, 1810, the Tonquin put to sea. Of her voyage to the mouth of the Columbia, Mr. Irving has given a somewhat ludicrous account. Thorne, the stern, straightforward officer of the Navy, having few ideas beyond those of duty and discipline, and looking with supreme contempt upon the motley lubbers who formed the greater part of his company, is painted with the easy yet spirited pencil of an artist indeed, while McDougall, the shrewd Scotch partner, bustling yet pompous and impressed with lofty notions of his own importance as proxy for Mr. Astor, is made as supremely ridiculous as possible, with as little apparent effort as can well be imagined. The portraits, however, carry upon their faces the evidence of their authenticity. The voyage is prosecuted amid a series of petty quarrels and cross purposes between the captain and his crew, and occasionally between Mr. Mackay and Mr. McDougall. The contests between the two latter gentlemen were brief, it appears, though violent. Within 15 minutes, says Captain Thorne in a letter to Mr. Astor, they would be caressing each other like children. The Tonquin doubled Cape Horn on Christmas Day, arrived at Owyhee on the 11th of February, took on board fresh provisions, sailed again with 12 Sandwich Islanders on the 28th, and on the 22nd of March arrived at the mouth of the Columbia. In seeking a passage across the bar, a boat and 9 men were lost among the breakers. On the way from Owyhee, a violent storm occurred, and the bickerings still continued between the partners and captain, the latter indeed grievously suspecting the former of a design to depose him. The Columbia, for about 40 miles from its mouth, is, strictly speaking, an estuary, varying in breadth from 3 to 7 miles, and indented by deep bays. Shoals and other obstructions render the navigation dangerous. Leaving this broad portion of the stream in the progress upward, we find the mouth of the river proper, which is about 0.5 mile wide. The entrance to the estuary from sea is bounded on the south by a long, low, and sandy beach stretching into the ocean and called Point Adams. On the northern side of the frith is Cape Disappointment, a steep promontory. Immediately east of this cape is Baker's Bay, and within this the Tonquin came to anchor. Jealousies still continued between the captain and the worthy McDougall, who would come to no agreement in regard to the proper location for the contemplated establishment. On April the 5th, without troubling himself further with the opinions of his coadjutors, Mr. Thorne landed in Baker's Bay and began operations. At this summary proceeding, the partners were, of course, in high dudgeon, and an open quarrel seemed likely to ensue, to the serious detriment of the enterprise. These difficulties, however, were at length arranged, and finally on the 12th of April a settlement was commenced at a point of land called Point George, on the southern shore of the Frith. Here was a good harbor where vessels of 200 tons might anchor within 50 yards of the shore. In honor of the chief partner, the new post received the title of Astoria. After much delay, the portion of the cargo destined for the post was landed, and the Tonquin left free to proceed on her voyage. She was to coast to the north to trade for peltries at the different harbors and to touch at Astoria on her return in the autumn. Mr. Mackay went in her as supercargo and Mr. Lewis as ship's clerk. On the morning of the 5th of June, she stood out to sea, the whole number of persons on board amounting to 23. In one of the outer bays, Captain Thorne procured the services of an Indian named Lamazi, who had already made 2 voyages along the coast and who agreed to accompany him as interpreter. In a few days, the ship arrived at Vancouver's Island and came to anchor in the harbor of Nuiti, much against the advice of the Indian, who warned Captain Thorne of the perfidious character of the natives. The result was the merciless butchery of the whole crew, with the exception of the interpreter and Mr. Lewis, the ship's clerk. The latter, finding himself mortally wounded and without companions, blew up the ship and perished with more than 100 of the enemy. Lamazi, getting among the Indians, escaped and was the means of bearing the news of the disaster to Astoria. In relating at length the thrilling details of this catastrophe, Mr. Irving takes occasion to comment on the headstrong, though brave and strictly honorable, character of Lieutenant Thorne. The danger and folly on the part of agents in disobeying the matured instructions of those who deliberately plan extensive enterprises, such as that of Mr. Astor, is also justly and forcibly shown. The misfortune here spoken of arose altogether from a disregard of Mr. A's often repeated advice, to admit but few Indians on board the Tonquin at one time. Her loss was a serious blow to the infant establishment at Astoria. To this post, let us now return. The natives inhabiting the borders of the estuary were divided into 4 tribes, of which the Chinooks were the principal. Comcomly, a one-eyed Indian, was their chief. These tribes resembled each other in nearly every respect and were, no doubt, of a common stock. They lived chiefly by fishing, the Columbia and its tributary streams abounding in fine salmon and a variety of other fish. A trade in peltries, but to no great amount, was immediately commenced and carried on. Much disquiet was occasioned at the post by a rumor among the Indians that 30 white men had appeared on the banks of the Columbia and were building houses at the Second Rapids. It was feared that these were an advance party of the Northwest Company, endeavoring to seize upon the upper parts of the river and thus forestall Mr. Astor in the trade of the surrounding country. Bloody feuds in this case might be anticipated, such as had prevailed between rival companies in former times. The intelligence of the Indians proved true. The Northwest had erected a trading house on the Spokane River, which falls into the North Branch of the Columbia. The Astorians could do little to oppose them in their present reduced state as to numbers. It was resolved, however, to advance a countercheck to the post on the Spokane, and Mr. David Stewart prepared to set out for this purpose, with 8 men and a small assortment of goods. On the 15th of July, when this expedition was about starting, a canoe manned with 9 white men and bearing the British flag entered the harbor. They proved to be the party dispatched by the rival company to anticipate Mr. Astor in the settlement at the mouth of the river. Mr. David Thompson, their leader, announced himself as a partner of the Northwest, but otherwise gave a very peaceable account of himself. It appears, however, from information subsequently derived from other sources, that he had hurried with a desperate haste across the mountains, calling at all the Indian villages in his march, presenting them with British flags, and proclaiming formally that he took possession of the country for the Northwest Company and in the name of the King of Great Britain. His plan was defeated, it seems, by the desertion of a great portion of his followers, and it was thought probable that he now merely descended the river with a view of reconnoitering. MacDougall treated the gentleman with great kindness, and supplied them with goods and provisions for their journey back across the mountains, this much against the wishes of Mr. David Stewart, who did not think the object of their visit entitled them to any favor. A letter for Mr. Astor was entrusted to Thompson. On the 23rd of July, the party for the region of the Spokane set out, and after a voyage of much interest, succeeded in establishing the first interior trading post of the company. It was situated on a point of land about 3 miles long and 2 broad, formed by the junction of the Okanagan with the Columbia. In the meantime, the Indians near Astor began to evince a hostile disposition, and a reason for this altered demeanor was soon after found in the report of the loss of the Tonquin. Early in August, the settlers received intelligence of her fate. They now found themselves in a perilous situation, a mere handful of men on a savage coast and surrounded by barbarous enemies. From their dilemma, they were relieved for the present by the ingenuity of MacDougall. The natives had a great dread of the smallpox, which had appeared among them a few years before, sweeping off entire tribes. They believed it an evil either inflicted upon them by the Great Spirit or brought among them by the white men. Seizing upon this latter idea, MacDougall assembled several of the chieftains whom he believed to be inimical, and informing them that he heard of the treachery of their northern brethren in regard to the Tonquin, produced from his pocket a small bottle. "The white men among you," said he, "are few in number, it is true, but they are mighty in medicine. See here, in this bottle I hold the smallpox safely corked up. I have but to draw the cork and let loose the pestilence, to sweep man, woman, and child from the face of the earth." The chiefs were dismayed. They represented to the great smallpox chief that they were the firmest friends of the white men, that they had nothing to do with the villains who murdered the crew of the Tonquin, and that it would be unjust in uncorking the bottle to destroy the innocent with the guilty. MacDougall was convinced. He promised not to uncork it until some overt act should compel him to do so. In this manner, tranquility was restored to the settlement. A large house was now built, and the frame of a schooner put together. She was named the Dolly and was the first American vessel launched on the coast. But our limits will not permit us to follow too minutely the details of the enterprise. The adventurers kept up their spirits, sending out occasional foraging parties in the Dolly, and looking forward to the arrival of Mr. Hunt. So wore away the year 1811 at the little post of Astoria. We now come to speak of the expedition by land. This, it will be remembered, was to be conducted by Mr. Wilson Price Hunt, a native of New Jersey. He is represented as scrupulously upright, of amiable disposition and agreeable manners. He had never been in the heart of the wilderness, but having been for some time engaged in commerce at St. Louis, furnishing Indian traders with goods, he had acquired much knowledge of the trade at second hand. Mr. Donald Mackenzie, another partner, was associated with him. He had been 10 years in the interior in the service of the Northwest Company and had much practical experience in all Indian concerns. In July 1810, the two gentlemen repaired to Montreal, where everything requisite to the expedition could be procured. Here they met with many difficulties, some of which were thrown in their way by their rivals. Having succeeded, however, in laying in a supply of ammunition, provisions, and Indian goods, they embarked all on board a large boat and, with a very inefficient crew, the best to be procured, took their departure from St. Anne's near the extremity of the island of Montreal. Their course lay up the Ottawa and along a range of small lakes and rivers. On the 22nd of July, they arrived at Mackinac, situated on Mackinac Island, at the confluence of Lakes Huron and Michigan. Here it was necessary to remain some time to complete the assortment of Indian goods and engage more voyageurs. While waiting to accomplish these objects, Mr. Hunt was joined by Mr. Ramsey Crooks, a gentleman whom he had invited by letter to engage as a partner in the expedition. He was a native of Scotland, had served under the Northwest Company, and been engaged in private trading adventures among the various tribes of the Missouri. Mr. Crooks represented in forcible terms the dangers to be apprehended from the Indians, especially the Blackfeet and Sioux, and it was agreed to increase the number of the party to 60 upon arriving at St. Louis. 30 was its strength upon leaving Mackinac. This occurred on the 12th of August. The expedition pursued the usual route of the fur trader, by Green Bay, Fox, and Wisconsin rivers to Prairie du Chien, and thence down the Mississippi to St. Louis, where they landed on the 3rd of September. Here, Mr. Hunt met with some opposition from an association called the Missouri Fur Company, and especially from its leading partner, a Mr. Manuel Lisa. This company had a capital of about $40,000 and employed about 250 men. Its object was to establish posts along the upper part of the river and monopolize the trade. Mr. H. proceeded to strengthen himself against competition. He secured to Mr. Astor the services of Mr. Joseph Miller. This gentleman had been an officer of the United States Army, but had resigned on being refused a furlough and taken to trading with the Indians. He joined the association as a partner, and on account of his experience and general acquirements, Mr. Hunt considered him a valuable coadjutor. Several boatmen and hunters were also now enlisted, but not until after a delay of several weeks. This delay and the previous difficulties at Montreal and Mackinac had thrown Mr. H. much behind his original calculations, so that he found it would be impossible to effect his voyage up the Missouri during the present season. There was every likelihood that the river would be closed before the party could reach its upper waters. To winter, however, at St. Louis would be expensive. Mr. H., therefore, determined to push up on his way as far as possible to some point where game might be found in abundance, and there take up his quarters until spring. On the 21st of October, he set out. The party were distributed in three boats, two large Schenectady barges, and a keelboat. By the 16th of November, they reached the mouth of the Nandoa, a distance of 450 miles, where they set up their winter quarters. Here Mr. Robert McClellan, at the invitation of Mr. Hunt, joined the association as a partner. He was a man of vigorous frame, of restless and imperious temper, and had distinguished himself as a partisan under General Wayne. John Day also joined the company at this place, a tall and athletic hunter from the backwoods of Virginia. Leaving the main body at Nadoa, Mr. Hunt now returned to St. Louis for a reinforcement. He was again impeded by the machinations of the Missouri Fur Company, but finally succeeded in enlisting one hunter, some voyageurs, and a Sioux interpreter, Pierre Dorion. With these, after much difficulty, he got back to the encampment on the 17th of April. Soon after this period, the voyage up the river was resumed. The party now consisted of nearly 60 persons, five partners, Hunt, Crooks, Mackenzie, Miller, and McClellan, one clerk, John Reed, 40 Canadian voyageurs, and several hunters. They embarked in four boats, one of which, of a large size, mounted a swivel and two howitzers.